hospitals often don't identify their donors very fully. They'll just use a nickname very often.
Really?
Oh yeah, we're taking 2 coins from Jenkins' mom. Or Kathy Taylor, yeah, we're getting stuff from her. And Carrie lives down there by the withered tree. I'm like, I'm so happy that you have these intimate social relationships, but please, for the love of God.
Hello and welcome to Medieval Pod, a podcast about how the medieval world influences the politics, ideas, and lives of modern people. This week, I speak with Dr. Lucy Barnhouse, a scholar of religion and medicine and assistant professor of history at Arkansas State, about medieval hospitals, plague narratives, and what medieval orientations toward care can teach us in the era of COVID-19.
Well, I was wondering if maybe you could start us off by introducing yourself and talking a little bit about the kind of research that you do.
Sure. I'm Dr. Lucy Barnhouse. I've recently started a position as assistant professor at Arkansas State University, and I do research on medieval hospitals as institutions and how their status as religious institutions, particularly, influenced their interactions with their community. So my research takes place, I would say, at a rather crowded intersection between religious, legal, medical, and urban history.
Yeah, that sounds quite crowded. Awesome, thank you. Well, tying into that a little bit, but starting off with maybe a little bit more of a broad question, I think anybody that works with medieval science or medicine more broadly is sort of familiar with the characterization of things like medieval medicine and medieval science as quite backwards and not forward thinking, and the medieval period in general as a time where there's not a lot of innovation in medical or scientific fields. And obviously we're having this conversation, that's not true.
Well, I mean, it is very frustrating because when I say medieval medicine, sometimes I just get a sort of noise. Sometimes like, leeches. Sometimes I get those existed, like they had hospitals back then, you know. So I do, you know, object to that whole sort of backwards, forwards framework, right? Because it does obscure so much about innovation, about practice, about observation, and about care. I think the individualized care provided in many medieval hospitals would be the envy of many hospital residents today. Recipe books speak to really carefully thought out and comprehensive, holistic regimens designed for people with different conditions, different needs, and designed to fit their emotional as well as physical well-being. The two were not conceptually separated. So I find it very exciting work, but it does mean dealing with the incredulity of strangers in elevators and students when teaching the history of medicine.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Did they have plague doctor masks? Did people take baths?
I mean, I do have a very good friend from grad school, actually, who is working on making me a COVID-19 mask with little cartoon 17th century plague doctors on them. So, but yes, I've said, no, those aren't medieval. familiar conversation for all of us, and to think broadly about hospitals as spaces, because the question of whether or not medieval hospitals count as real hospitals, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that word is a good word for the institutional construct, the physical space, the type of work that happens there, that's been much debated in the historiography. Mm-hmm. And I think that still is to some extent, although that's become less of an issue as more historians rather than medical doctors are writing history of medieval medicine.
I was sort of wondering what you think are like the biggest misconceptions that you see about medieval public health, and I think you've gotten to a lot of those.
Actually, there's one more big one,
Okay.
Which I encounter a lot among undergraduates, and I don't know whether that would be less true among, you know, other folk I encounter, or whether they're just too shy to ask. My students always assume, I mean, and this, I'm speaking from the US, that people had to pay for hospital stays. And it blows their minds when I say that no, part of the point, the raison d'être, the identity of these institutions is that, you know, you don't have to pay. Of course, there is the somewhat vexed historiographical question of people who sort of paid for permanent residence in hospitals, paid for entry, gave donations to the hospitals of land, goods, income, whatever, and then became resident in hospitals in their old age as pensioners or Corodians. Work that's been done, I think, shows that hospitals probably usually broke even on that deal, but in the late Middle Ages as well, not just for modern scholars, there was a very serious question about whether taking in such people without immediate acute need, clearly without the poverty that was the background of many hospital residents, whether this was a corruption of hospitals' mission to serve the sick poor, to serve the poor of Christ, or whether, because these people were aged and infirm, whether this indeed rendered them part of that category whose mission it was, whose mission it was. The part of the category whom hospitals served as their institutional mission. Sorry. But from the everyday data I have of account books and charters, it seems pretty clear to me that hospitals saw this as part of their mission. Although, of course, we get into the vexed question then of rhetoric. Of course, they would frame donation charters in the language of canon law to be like, see how we are serving the infirm.
That's fascinating. So, like, patients' identities as, socially, medically, and sort of religiously, maybe that's an overgeneralization, we're all
I would say, yes, but it can be hard to tell extent to which patient, and patient is a very vexed word, which you'll notice that I have not used for people resident in medieval.
Oh, hospital. Interesting. Why is that?
Well, right, it's from patiens, for suffering, right? And whereas now, certainly, we think of going into the hospital as the result of an acute situation that is then hopefully resolved. The extent to which this was true is notoriously, infamously hard to determine in the Middle Ages. And I think there is still some debate, but most medievalists I know who work on this say hospital residents or the sick in hospitals, because the identity of patient also as constructed in the modern period is quite different from the sort of relationship of these people to space, the people who are receiving care, right, to the space and to those providing care and to overall institutional structures.
Okay.
Hoping to get through this without mentioning Foucault, but he lurks, right?
He lurks. He always lurks. Actually, I spoke with somebody about Foucault last week, and I was like, Foucault. And they were like, yeah.
Foucault.
You can't say anything about him without, like, shaking your fist if you're but, okay, cool. I will keep that in mind. Residence. That's really interesting. I was wondering, maybe turning a little bit more specifically towards hospitals then, I was wondering if you could talk about what the development of medieval urban hospitals looks like in the Middle Ages. Like, are they always kind of a feature of medieval cities, or is there a time period where they're sort of becoming more present, or all of that?
Yes, I would say. Mary Rothaclay in 1909. Wrote of the hospital as one of the key institutions of the Middle Ages. And many historians, since in multiple languages and traditions, have also spoken of hospitals as a key urban institution, coming into being as independent institutions in ways that I believe are inextricably connected with the development of canon law in the late 12th and particularly in the 13th centuries. They're not exclusively urban institutions, though, I would like to say. Many. Smaller towns also had hospitals, but often lacked the document-keeping infrastructures that would enable those hospital records to survive. So this is very frustrating to me as a researcher, especially thinking about hospitals and place, right? Because we get scattered geographic references to hospitals in small communities, and we don't know from that reference, right, how these hospitals compared in terms of staff, size, etc., to those in larger cities. Well, we may be able to say that the big hospitals like that in Paris, at Potendieu, right, with a couple hundred beds, right, those are obviously the outliers. And a more common size is from, you know, half a dozen to a couple of dozen. It can be hard to tell what those hospitalia, right, or whatever the name is in Adakia, of the small towns were. Isolated charters suggest to me that they were perceived as performing similar social functions and that they managed relationships with donors, neighbors, property, right, in very similar ways to their urban counterparts. But to circle back to the question you actually asked about cities, right, I just wanted to say, like, they're not exclusively an urban institution, but certainly in mid-sized cities and upwards, you get hospital landscapes, right? So you get multiple hospitals, sometimes competing hospitals. The Templars and Mainz's oldest hospital got into a legal debate about who was allowed to take care of the leprous in the 1220s. Yeah, I know.
Interesting.
Yes, indeed. High drama. And while we lack foundation charters in many cases, hospitals emerge into the documentary record, and this is, you know, a claim I'm making, largely in response to the refined criteria for religious institutions, right? So they start having more of a stake in creating documents saying, look, this is what we are doing. We are independent institutions following a rule. See how legal we are, caring for the sick. See how we are also doing this good thing that canon law requires us to do. And they do become vital fixtures of cities in the later Middle Ages. From the 13th century on, especially. And of course, this is a multi-factor situation. That's an inelegant way of putting it, I'm sorry. But there are many factors contributing to the rise of hospitals. Adam J. Davis recently has a book out about how the rise of commerce and an idea of charities working in tandem contribute to interest in funding hospitals. And also, of course, there is the conspicuous social fact, right, that in cities, you're going to have more people moving through and potentially in need of support, right? Life happens, people get sick, and potentially also, right, more people without extended kin group structures in the city who then are relying on civic institutions to, for care of one kind or another. So hospitals are a key part of city landscapes, and they can be located in a number of different ways in the city. We often find hospitals close to cathedrals in cathedral cities, in the cathedral close sometimes initially, sort of coming out of, you know, communities under the aegis of the cathedral and then receiving sort of formal institutionalization. Hospitals are also sometimes located in clusters of buildings that are symbolically significant to the city, which is what I mean by civic institutions. Mm-hmm. Essentially that you'll find the hospital next to the city council house or next to other, you know, significant buildings of the economy of the city. Also, as Annie Lester and others have observed, we can find hospitals in sort of peri-urban belts of charitable institutions. So to take Mainz as an example, where there are four different independent hospitals, you have the oldest hospital, which starts near the cathedral, then moves out to the city walls. and has its own door leading out of the city walls, right? So people can come in at night and get shelter, which is very nice. Then we have another hospital that is located in a belt of sort of what I would call a green strip with a number of other religious institutions as well. Mm-hmm. And some health hazards. So it's a mixture of, oh, you know, cannons, the hospital, right? Some pigs, the dyers, right? So all these, you know, potentially, these things are sort of grouped. And the Leprosarium has two locations. It has one chapel inside in that belt of religious institutions / health hazards, and one location about a mile outside the walls. When I was teaching at Fordham, I used to use the marker. I would say, okay, from this classroom where we are now on our Bronx campus to the Mexican restaurant that is on, you know, 187. I said, that's about the same distance that the Leprosarium was outside the city walls. And the students would be shocked. They're like, that isn't very far at all. I'm like, I know it's not very far at all. You see the point I'm reaching at, right? This is not a location of segregation, but rather one that allowed them to be active in local economies and communities. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. Is there a reason there were two separate Leprosaria in this town? Or?
Tragically, not that I know of. yes, really. They are clearly linked. They are referred to in linked ways. There is a community that appears to be resident at the chapel in the city to take care of people who are there. Mm-hmm. And then there's the location outside the walls. I would be tempted to describe the chapel as almost a satellite location, even though it's in the city. Mm-hmm. But yes, no idea, no suggestive evidence for that.
Huh.
Just by local.
That's really interesting.
Huh. I mean, there are sometimes multiple communities of the leprous in or around medieval cities, especially if you start counting semi-formal groupings, which may not be incorporated as religious institutions in the same way until much later. Mm. But a mystery. No.
That's so interesting. Hospital mystery. Cool. Well, I mean, as we've just finished talking about how diverse these hospitals were and how different their aims and resident populations were, perhaps this is an overly broad question, but what were the physical spaces or physical buildings of these hospitals generally like?
That's a great question. One thing that might make me a little cautious is the possible survival bias towards hospitals that were a bit larger, right, and better established. But generally speaking, and I'm building on scholarship that's looked at hospitals all over Northwestern Europe at this point, you would have maybe two floors with a lower, you know, big bay with a chapel at one end, maybe some side chapels as well for the residents, for the sick. Some of those bays at least might be sort of curtained off for privacy, and there might also be a section, there were sometimes at least sections for the more seriously ill that might be closer to the sleeping quarters of the staff and might have a fire also to keep them warmer, the more vulnerable, the more fragile populations. And in the later Middle Ages, at least, you have these gorgeous Gothic buildings. Mainz's oldest hospital survives as a popular and excellent brunch spot. If you're ever in Mainz, the Heiliggeist comes recommended. Patio seating, indoor seating. The upstairs then is where the staff live. The interior of the hospital was remodeled in the 15th century, which from my perspective is a bummer, except it's a beautiful brunch spot. I would love to know what it looks like, obviously. But there were some key attributes, like spaces for the beds to be placed so that the staff could move around freely. And artistic representations suggest this, as well as surviving architectural evidence. The sick might be two to a bed. And you'll have exterior doors. The chapel is very important because, of course, spiritual health is also key. And gazing at Christ crucified, right, or suffering saints is also a form of therapy and identification. And you see the art does not often survive, but it sometimes does, or we at least have textual evidence that says, oh, well, the altar of St. John the Baptist on the side gets a priest, right, and the altar of St. Agnes here gets a priest. But the hospitals also were designed as therapeutic spaces. Mm-hmm. So they were designed to have light, flowing air, ideally running water quite nearby, which ties in with Galenic theory, right? With having your surroundings managed. Peregrine Horton refers to the hospital as a non-natural environment, right? It's very organized towards healing. Mm-hmm. It also brings in some parellels, as I discovered, well, you know, pictures of suffering Christ, right, are perhaps in the minority. Talked to a woman who worked at Montefiore in the Bronx a few years ago, I discovered that research shows that paintings of, you know, running water or similar calming things reduce rehab time for patients recovering from knee injuries and similar, and that increasingly hospitals are designing green space, right, yards, benches, that kind of thing, for the solace of patients visiting them, caring for and about them. So I'm really fascinated by this resurgence of sort of reconceptualizing the hospital, not just as the 20th century, 19th century clinic, but a space that is more holistically designed to care for and support the person.
That's fascinating. That's amazing. So, it sounds like hospitals were functioning as, you know, in certain senses as their own ecosystems, and then also in certain senses as parts of the community that were very vital. Were hospitals, I feel like thinking about hospitals now, and this could be from my experience as somebody that hasn't spent a lot of time in hospitals, they tend to be sort of, you go there when you are ill as a patient, or you're visiting somebody who's ill sometimes, but they're sort of removed from most other, you know, urban or city functions. At least in terms of like somebody's day-to-day life. How do I want to phrase this question? I guess I'm wondering whether medieval hospitals were a place where there was a lot of, but where people were going in and out, not necessarily as residents, but as
visitor traffic.
Visitors. Yeah, yeah.
This is a fascinating question. and of course, perhaps as always, as medievalists, right, this is one of those things that I come up against and say, I really wish I could say more definite things about the ways in which hospitals were hubs of mobility.
Yeah.
I believe that they were. And I have several reasons for doing so. Not the least of which is that often donation charters to hospitals reflect a very intimate knowledge of hospital routines.
Hmm.
Some of this, of course, might be negotiated in the charter drafting phase with the staff, like, oh, well, what do you need? But based on the number of things that come from their personal revenues, etc., it's suggestive to me that people often say, oh, I would like to give, you know, eggs for the sick to have on this day. I would like to give chicken for this season and fish for this season. I would like to give candles to be burned on this and that feast, right? The other clear suggestive evidence we have for hospitals as spaces of traffic and visitation and integration is that hospitals not infrequently got into disputes with parish priests. about the rights to say Mass. And even here, so obviously, right, the prayers of the sick poor are valuable. So the healthy residents of the city are very interested in obtaining these prayers, but also interested in, it would seem to me, praying with the sick and receiving the sacrament in their company. So whether this was motivated by sort of extended works of mercy, or you know, was often family members, people engaged in caring for people from the neighborhood, both parish disputes and donation charters seem to me to suggest that there would have been a fair bit of traffic in and out of the hospital chapel, particularly, which is an integrated space, usually, especially on feast days relevant to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Also rent gathering. Hospital staff, in some cases, did inspection routes, but there are also hospital account books indicating that, you know, rents would have been gathered, you know, on a certain day. And while we may not know for certain whether that involved hospital staff going out and saying, hey, I'll have those two chickens, how's everything going, how are the kids, or people coming into the hospital courtyard and saying, hey, I brought the two chickens, right? Yeah. Lovely weather we're having, the Rhine won't flood this year, you know, that's a bit unclear. But there is interaction. And in all of the cities I've looked at, really, the descriptions of hospitals make it clear that they were points of orientation in neighborhoods. Like, oh, you go past the hospital and then, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a mixed joy and frustration of the archives. My hospitals often don't identify their donors very fully. They'll just use a nickname very often. Really? Oh yeah, we're taking two coins from Jenkins' mom. Or yeah, Kathy the sailor, yeah, we're getting stuff from her. And you know, Harry lives down there by the withered tree. I'm like, I'm so happy that you have these intimate social relationships, but please, for the love of God. I think that, well, even more interestingly, I shouldn't begrudge the 14th century scribes their account keeping habits, because you can see the nicknames concentrated in the neighborhoods around the hospital. And then as they get like 2 miles out in the villages, then you're like, well, it's so-and-so, son of so-and-so who lives here, right? So it's an assumption of less regular interaction, less intimate social knowledge.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's awesome. That's so funny. That's such a medieval, medieval scribes. That's such a, that's so,
yeah.
That's amazing. That's so cool. I want to ask more about that, but I think that I, one thing that you just brought up, in terms of people wanting to pray either with the sick or to, drop off their rent, you know, in an area where there are a lot of sick people, or just be in the hospital around people who are ill. I think now, at least personally, I would assume like, oh, okay, people would prefer, especially now with COVID, but just in general, people would prefer not to be around people who are ill, or just generally. And a lot of that is because of our different modern ideas about disease and transmission and everything. But were there do you think there would have been similar concerns about like, oh, okay, I shouldn't necessarily be around people who are ill? Or do you think that was not a, what do you think about that? I don't know if that's a bad way of framing it, but.
As so often, perhaps in the European Middle Ages, Christianity makes things complicated. Because I think part of the reason that we do see saints ministering to the leprous, for instance, and the works of mercy, works of charity being framed as visitation of the sick, feeding of the hungry, burying of the dead, increasingly in later Middle Ages, is precisely because it goes against the social norm of not endangering yourself, not putting aside your own priorities, right, in order to minister to the sick. Hospital staff, right, took religious vows, and their religious vow was, in addition to poverty, chastity, and obedience, service of the sick. This was a solemn pledge, you know, I will serve God in this place and his sick poor.
poor. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that we see this highlighted is in part precisely because it is subverting some other priorities. I mean, since you brought up our own contemporary plague, this is one of the things that is highlighted as, you know, sad and abnormal by chroniclers, writers of narrative sources at the time of the Black Death outbreaks in the mid to later 14th century, that people are not visiting the sick as they should, right? That people are deserting, right? That people are no longer performing their duties. Yeah. As far back as the Third Lateran Council, maybe the Third Lateran Council is famous for dictating that leper hospitals have to have their own chapel and their own priest, because the idea that these people would not be integrated in the body of Christ was a scandal. So yeah. They have to be integrated in this way, even if they are not living in the city, if they are set apart from the healthy in some ways. And what it means to be set apart, I would also argue, is conditional, right? It means you only come into the city on certain days, you don't use the bathhouses, you don't touch food when you're shopping in the market, right? So the lepers are the original socially distanced, but they are still interacting, right?
That's interesting. I was going to ask you kind of a more broad question about like preventative health and public health measures, like whether medieval societies had like larger scale, like, okay, in order to prevent spread of disease, we're not going to do this, we're going to do this.
Yes.
But I think that that's fascinating that a lot of those restrictions would apply specifically to people with leprosy, but they wouldn't be like total, it sounds like. They were just
right, no, not total at all. Not total at all. Yes, I mean, I have many colleagues, the historians of, leprosy, and the leprous, right? That's almost another conversation. This process of social diagnosis and medical diagnosis and how those things are linked and separate. But did they have public health measures? Yes. Carol Rockliffe has done really good work on this. Guy Geltner has done really good work on this. And I think, touched with it, it's a growing field as people look at environmental history and pre-modern health policy. It's not always centralized. So when you say, you know, people said, okay, we are not going to do X and Y. Yes, of course, in lots of urban environments, you see very clear central ordinances governing public health. And in other places, you see this negotiated more on a case-by-case basis about water access. But I would say that in both the place of centralized policy and in a more decentralized landscape of public health, we see a very genuine concept of public health as a public good. I would really love to set some medieval civic governments loose on devising appropriate punishments for people who don't wear their masks properly. I think the kind of imagination of medieval civic bureaucrats is exactly what we need in this particular historical moment. But yeah, I would say we see a very robust concept of public health as part of the collective moral good of a society.
I mean, it absolutely makes sense, right? Like, considering medieval people's, religious and social, thank you.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I am always here talking about my own specialty, chiefly of Northwestern Europe. But we see this, we see similar concepts of integrated physical, public, moral health in the Islamic world, clearly, clearly sort of offhandedly, but you know, in the market officials, in the mutasibs, in the construction of bimaristans. I speak to my European expertise.
Okay. So I have a couple more questions for you, if that's okay. This is sort of a very broad question. And so if it's not especially relevant, that's okay. So we've talked a lot about public health. We've talked a lot about hospitals in particular. I was wondering whether and how much in the course of your research you have focused on or found I have patients written here, I'll say residents. residents, official sort of individual experiences of their hospital stays and how much that functions in your research. Is that something that exists or is that kind of a mystery?
Very often, right, the direct experiences of sickness, right, of what it was like to be sick, what it was like to be a member of the sick poor resident in the hospital, mm-hmm. that is frustratingly perhaps the most elusive thing. Mm-hmm. In some wills and testaments and bequests, we get people talking about their physical infirmities, saying, well, I am weak in body, but I am still firm in mind, mm-hmm. or experiences of sickness, as in the case of a scribe for the leper hospital who said, oh, well, this was all copied down by an assistant because I was really sick that day, but here I've signed off on it. This is all correct. Right. So we get that usually quite indirectly. One of the exceptions is for the experiences of those who underwent at their own initiative or at the persuasion of their neighbors, examinations for leprosy specifically in cities. And most of this surviving evidence is from quite late in the Middle Ages, 15th century. And so there we get some more evidence for saying, well, we had been ill for a while and we were worried that it might be leprosy, or you know, this woman was weak and we thought we should get it checked out. You know, the verdict of our local health professionals was inconclusive, so we send them to you, oh, wise and honorable lords of the Leprosy Inspection Committee in Frankfurt, our very good friends, right? Yeah. It goes on. And there we do get some sense of how the experience of sickness was affected by social class, by gender, by existing social relationships, which is both fascinating and poignant. But we get very little, alas, of the individual experience of frailty, of suffering. One poignant and interesting case I find is that of a certain Werner, who worked as a hospital staff member, sort of overseer, manager, for the so-called new hospital in Mainz. And when he made his own sort of final bequests, he arranged gifts of property to the hospital he had served and to hospitals near the place where he was born, and wished to spend his own final years, right, if when he became too infirm to work in a hospital. So the fact that a man who had intimate day in, day out, nitty gritty knowledge of what went into managing a hospital, what could go wrong, supply and demand, wished to end his days in such a space and in such a community is, I think, very touching and speaks to his commitment, his belief in this kind of institution. It might also vary, right, depending on whether this was a multi-purpose hospital where you went for a specific need, or if you're looking at a leprosarium where most residents are there long-term. So it becomes a permanent community with all the joys, irritations, ups and downs, that. So disallowing body songs, for instance, commanding sermon attendance, saying you absolutely do have to get permission before going out to have dinner with friends in the town, right? You just can't wander off, which has a lot to do with religious status as well.
Yeah.
The archivist of Mainz, Wolfgang Dobras, when I was first starting my own work in the archives, came over specifically to tell me the story of a leper who had left the leper hospital without permission because he wanted to participate in carnival festivities. And we know this because he was disciplined for getting very drunk indeed and causing a bit of a public nuisance. Yeah. Yes, just wild times on the town in 14th century Germany.
Good for him.
Yes, right. It's impossible not to sympathize with going to experience carnival. And interestingly, the record does not say that people, you know, were really abhorred that a leper would be out among them, but just that he was making nuisance of himself by being really loud and singing.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you. That's always a complication / tragedy with medieval sources. It's like, well, right, you know.
Well, right, especially from a medical humanities perspective, especially from a disability studies perspective, right, that's something we always want, right? What about the experience of the most vulnerable people, right, in this space, in this social constellation? Yeah. And that is often elusive. Prescriptive sources command that the staff are to serve the sick humbly and gently. And sometimes also that the sick are to be meek and not quarrelsome. So this perhaps tells us something about the directions in which things were perceived as maybe going awry, but very little to tell us more directly of that kind of experience, alas.
I think it's possible to talk quite a bit about comparisons between medieval and modern thought, you know, scientifically and medically. And it's possible for that to be really ahistorical, obviously, but it's also, I think, possible for it to be kind of fruitful and interesting, hopefully. And so, as we kind of talked about at the beginning, today we tend to use medieval public health and science as kind of a retrospective frame to say, oh, well, that was very backwards and we know better now, you know, we've progressed and now we don't do this sort of, you know, silly thing anymore and look how advanced we are. But I was wondering if there are any aspects of medieval public health that, are there any aspects of those things that you think compare positively to our kind of modern experience with health in hospitals? Or do you think that there are any aspects of those things that can resonate with what we might be experiencing, especially right now, but just generally.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. On both counts. So you say we, you know, think of the medieval as modernity's other. I would suggest that hopefully we as medievalists are constantly pushing back against that kind of dichotomy and against an approach that by default, you know, ipso facto views the medieval as something that has been, must be, right, left behind or rejected, or moved on from. For this very reason, when I was given the chance to teach a history of medicine, right, from ancient to the present, I refused to teach it in chronological order. I taught it precisely because I did not want my students thinking about, okay, well, now we're with the Greeks, now we're moving forward slowly, right, towards 21st century medicine. But rather think about how have we thought about bodies? How have we thought about hospitals? How have we thought about germs, right? Germs before germ theory, if you will. Infection, disability, right? Things like this. So, yes, I would say perhaps especially now, the idea of public health as a moral good and about a community's ability and collective will to uphold public health as a moral index for that community, I think that is really pertinent to our own experiences today. And if thinking about our experience of COVID-19 and people's experience of the Black Death in the world of the mid-14th century, I think there really are a lot of parallels, right? This was perceived by them as a totally new thing, and that was part of what made it scary, right? That for all their medical knowledge, for all the universities, all the published treatises, right, all the existing public health policies, this was a new disease, and it traveled fast and it struck hard. And you know, whether we say, well, surfaces, aerosols, God knows what the symptoms are, you know, or if you're saying, well, perhaps this is God's will, perhaps this is a malign conjunction of planets, perhaps it's the, you know, perhaps it's some combination of these things. Either way, the entire atmosphere is out to get you. And that's a very scary place to be in. Perhaps there's less contrast between a medieval sense of vulnerability in the face of nature and fortune than between a modern sense of comparative invulnerability and vulnerability to disease in our own historical moment. But that's perhaps an imponderable, right? That's a hypothetical. And Yes. I think for as historians thinking empathetically about the past and thinking about how we speak with it, what it has to tell us, how we enter into dialogue with it, right? It's avoiding the twin fallacies of, these people and this society and these attitudes were totally different. And, they were just like us, really. But one of the things that I find really compelling about medieval medicine is to see the compassion and courage and commitment with which people engaged illness. Perhaps especially moving for me was a collection of recipes that I found dedicated to leprosy and specifically to care for the lepers in a hospital environment, in a sort of environment that could be totally managed. Because the book, the folio go on for, you know, six, you know, close written manuscript pages, right? You know, front and back, about drafts of cool white wine with sugar in the mornings, right? Because leprosy was thought to be a heating and drying disease. Cool white wine with sugar in the mornings, as many baths as they liked, because this was good for the mood as well as for the skin. About treatments of massage oils that would have cleared psoriasis right up and would have at least provided relief from itching discomfort if people did have what we now identify as Hansen's disease. And this goes on and on and on about recommended diet and about care and about trying to prevent injury due to what we would call right nerve damage. And then at the very end of these closely written, argued, cross-referenced pages on how to care for people with a certain condition, it ends, "And for this we know there is no cure." So there are these records of, right, implicitly, right, communities committed to emotionally and physically intensive care for something that they knew they couldn't ultimately cure, right? Even then. And we have the same records for taking care of everything from chilblains, arthritis, right? The illnesses attendant upon poverty. When we find medical recipe collections that seem to have been used in hospitals, they concentrate about the illnesses of poverty and old age. And they are dedicated to providing salves, ointments, stuff to help when your throat feels like it's being pierced by a little spear. Use copper bowls, use clean cloths, wash your hands, collect these herbs, don't collect those herbs, and provide chicken and barley. So there's lots of material, right, that I think tells us of commitment to trying to make the lives of people who are vulnerable a little bit easier.
That's wonderful. That's amazing.
Thank you. That's my soapbox for medieval medicine.
Yeah, it's a great soapbox to have.
Thank you.
I think that's actually a great place to end. Were there any other sort of things we didn't get to or questions you wanted to raise that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
I think I've gotten a chance to give all my favorite plugs for how medieval medicine shows us a landscape of care rather than of, you know, backwards horror and leeches. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you for giving us a window into that. It's so important to think about that and remember that. Was there anything that you wanted to plug specifically, like any projects you're working on or...
Oh, goodness. Well, I do have a book on medieval hospitals coming not very soon to an academic library for you. More frequently and accessibly, I work on the Footnoting History podcast, where I speak often on topics including medical history, women's history, and those things I just don't have time to squeeze into lectures.
Okay, fantastic. Please check that out, anyone who's listening. And thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Emily. It's been a pleasure.
Medieval Pod is produced and hosted by me, Emily Price. Our theme song is Through the City 2 by Crowander, used under a Creative Commons BYNC non-commercial license. Our logo was designed by Kat Schneider. You can find the show notes and additional learning resources at medievalpod.newmedialab.cuny.edu. and you can follow us on Twitter @MedievalPod.